that was put on the record.
Just to put on the record.
Put my remarks on the record.
You're on the record.
You are on the record with Atika Hurley. Curtin University and the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute have published new research showing the true cost of housing goes far beyond weekly rent or mortgage repayments. Study author and Curtin Research Fellow Dr. Adam Crowe says the analysis revealed how lower income households are particularly disadvantaged, and it's crucial to expand the definition of housing affordability to include factors such as location, energy efficiency, and the hidden costs associated with poor quality housing. Dr. Crowe joins me this morning in the studio to chat about this further. Good morning, Dr. Crowe.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
How is housing affordability measured?
In Australia?
Yes.
A few different ways, but typically you'll see in a lot of mainstream media, it's defined as spending less than 30% of household income on housing. That's classed as being affordable. In the policy settings, in the policy circles, there's a variation on that definition, because without having, I guess, a little bit more nuance to that, you could be on an income of $300,000 a year and you're paying more than 30% for housing. Is that really housing unaffordability? The research would say no, because you're choosing to pay for a, you know, $2.3 million house. So in the policy settings, it's defined as the lowest 40% of income earners. If that cohort, so they're your low to moderate income households, if those cohorts are paying more than 30% of their household income for housing, then that's classed as having a housing affordability issue. That's when policy mechanisms start to come into place. This research is adding some complexity to that. It's scoping, it's asking, should we be looking more at affordable living and the true cost of housing, because housing can be really poorly located, not well located to your social networks, your places of employment, or the major centres of employment. So there's a locational, spatial disadvantage attributed to that, which has financial implications, and then also the quality of that home to begin with. So what is its thermal energy performance? What are the structural conditions of that? Is it susceptible to mold, drafts, like vermin, you know, rats, bugs? So it's kind of the research is problematizing the sticker price on rents and mortgages in Australia, and how they're used to inform housing affordability, and then housing affordability problems, which is where the governments at varying levels then see it as an issue that they need to try to resolve through different types of policy mechanisms.
Right, and you kind of touched on it there, but how do lower income households make other trade-offs? Like, what role does transport costs play in housing affordability as well?
It's a good question. And in the report, we're arguing that there's some of the hidden costs, not just financial costs, but the cost to your everyday life, your well-being, having to spend maybe 2 hours commuting from, you know, Western Sydney, because that was where the affordable, quote unquote, affordable housing was to get to the CBD for your place of work. You might be a key worker working in nursing, teaching, and this is an issue in a lot of the inner city metros across Australia, where key workers, so not only low income households, but those middle, moderate and middle income households who need to work in a particular place. So if you work at a hospital, you need to live within a relatively close commuting distance to that. It's just become too unaffordable for even your middle income households, especially a single income household, to live within close proximity. So the trade-offs that are being made are to live, okay, I'll live 40 kilometres away. I most likely won't have great access in terms of public transportation to my place of work. So private vehicle is the only option. And there's a lot of additional research showing the health and well-being implications of spending more than an hour a day in traffic, getting from your residence to the place of work, not to mention the environmental implications of that.
And do you have any suggestions for policies that need to be changed or made?
In terms of the spatial component?
Yeah, or just even with poor quality housing and how the government can better integrate housing and transport and employment policies.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't mind, maybe I'll just back up a little bit and talk about those two things, those two factors. So, the research was looking at the quality of the home. Mm. There is a lot of research that's been done on the quality of the home, specifically looking at the thermal performance. Mm. We use a energy efficiency rating system in Australia called NatHERS. It's a nationwide, what does NatHERS stand for? Nationwide Housing Energy Rating System. Mm. There's been some improvements to the star rating of new dwellings in Australia. They were implemented last year through changes to the National Construction Code. However, they only apply to new buildings. Mm. Other studies have shown that the majority of Australian homes don't meet 2 stars, and the current standard is 7 stars. Wow. Research that came out last week, published by the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, showed that to meet our international counterparts, so countries across the EU, US, UK, we need to be hitting 9.5 stars. But that's just a bit of context to show that the majority of housing in Australia is at 2 star. And there is a... there's an uneven distribution of that thermal efficiency based on household income and tenure. So private renters are bearing the brunt of this, living in really poor, thermally inefficient housing. To compensate that, you have to drive your air conditioner to stop your house from being extremely hot in summer, and then obviously use heating systems, especially in certain parts of Australia where it does get quite cold, to try to keep your home comfortable. There are issues with that as well. Some households simply can't afford paying, you know, triple, quadruple the price for maintaining thermal comfort throughout the year. So they're making decisions, it's called energy rationing, where they're choosing not to run the heater in peak winter, choosing not to run the air conditioner. So they're choosing to, you know, rug up or, you know, strip off, and there's severe physical and mental health implications for that. So that's just an example of one of the trade-offs that is often made. But obviously that experience and those, say, financial implications of having energy bills that are, you know, 4 or 5 times more than than living in a home that meets the higher star energy performance rating, that has, yeah, significant financial implications for households that flies completely under the radar when we're looking at those housing affordability metrics. You know, are you paying less than 30%? Of your household income in housing? Yep. Oh, okay, great. There's no problem because your housing is affordable, but it doesn't take into consideration the financial costs, but also the health and well-being costs of living in a housing that is of poor quality or substandard. The same goes on the spatial location of housing. So we had a very quick chat about that before. Mm-hmm. You'll typically find in most Australian cities, which are, have significant urban sprawl. I mean, look at the size of Perth. Our suburban area, you know, goes now from Yanchep to South Mandurah, with our major employment area still being the CBD. Yep. Yes, there's employment areas scattered around, but not to the same extent you would see in a lot of other international cities where there is there's a lot more mixed use of the land in the sense where you've got housing, employment centres, transport. So you have these, the 15, 30-minute city has gained a lot of traction lately. Mm. And that's not to say that you should be able to get from Yanchep to Perth CBD in 30 minutes. It's that every neighbourhood has its own kind of centre where there's employment opportunities, care opportunities, education opportunities and recreational opportunities. So you have all of these little microcosms around the city where each area is close to amenities.
Yeah.
In Australia, we are seeing a lot of spatial disadvantage in all of our major cities, and a lot of that comes to do with the housing that is considered affordable being in poorly located. So that's poor access to public transportation, poor access to a diversity of amenities that one a household might need, and therefore having to make particular trade-offs, okay, yeah, spend 2 hours a day commuting or not seeing my family. I might see my family once a month because they do live 40 kilometres away, because we just can't live in an area that that supports that type of connectivity.
So you do think, like, developing these little, I like the word microcosm that you used, in further out suburbs, this would kind of not give a solution but develop... Is that something?
Yeah, it's hard to answer that.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to resolve an issue that's come about through the Australian cities growing rapidly. At the same time, the automobile, so cars, came to Australia. So if you look at a lot of like Asian cities, European cities, even some US cities, their city establishment, their growth happened before the car era.
Yeah.
Obviously, Los Angeles is a completely different example compared to, say, parts of New York. But if you look at the European cities, they all were established before the car era. So it was all about accessibility, walking to your place of employment, or good public transport access, cycling infrastructure. We are now starting to... As a nation, starting to realise how unsustainable and impactful it is on people's lives, living, you know, 60 kilometres from your major employment centre. And so we have to try to work backwards to resolve those issues. So all state governments, federal governments as well, have housing infill targets. So we have a massive housing supply shortage in Australia right now, which is impacting people across the country in terms of extremely high rents, low rent vacancy, but also house prices. So pushing people who maybe 10 years ago would have transitioned into home ownership, that's been delayed significantly, or it is now a barrier where people can no longer get into home ownership. So they're staying in the private rental sector longer. Also, our social housing is not up to standard. It has been diminished over the past 3 or 4 decades. And so you have people on the social housing wait list also competing for housing in the private rental market. So there's a lot of pressure on getting new housing delivered. That's a big national conversation. You hear that in Perth. It's all about supply, supply, supply. From the housing research perspective, we're saying yes, supply, but we need to think strategically about, well, what does that type of supply mean? We argue for housing diversity, so not just your Australian dream type, you know, 4-bed, 2-bath suburban home, and then on the other end a 30-story high rise. They shouldn't be the only two options when we're talking about new housing supply. That's currently what's coming through. What's absent from the housing system, which would feedback to our conversation about these kind of microcosms, is what's called the missing middle. So medium density housing, terraced housing, you know, 3, 4, 5-story walk-ups, like what you'd see in a lot of like European and Asian cities, where on the ground floor there might be some commercial, and then you have residential up above. Included in that, there is a need to address the spatial disadvantage, so not just pushing lower and moderate income people to the urban periphery where it is a little bit more affordable. is to include a concept in new developments called inclusionary zoning. Inclusionary zoning is where a proportion of a development, let's say it's a 20-unit apartment, 20% of that needs to be dedicated to affordable housing. From a private developer perspective, that's very difficult for them to do because they will say it's unfeasible to deliver this property and sell 20% to a social housing provider, either at the cost of construction or definitely below market. So what you're seeing in parts of New South Wales, in the ACT, they're following principles adopted throughout the US, Europe and the UK, where, yes, there's an affordable housing requirement to this new development, but the local planning authority, so the local government, can provide some concessions to the developer to say, okay, yep, you're working with us to provide a diversity of housing, so housing that's affordable to people across the income spectrum. We can give you some either a tax concession or we can give you a density bonus where, okay, the local area has a four-storey height restriction. If you deliver 20% affordable housing, we'll allow you to go to 5 or 6. There's no hard or fast rule how to apply those concessions. It really depends on the local context. A quiet suburban street might not be the best location to put a six-story apartment. But if we're talking about a high street, we're sitting here on Beaufort Street in Mount Lawley. City of Vincent typically has a 5 or 6 story height limit. If some of those could go up to 6, 7 stories to enable the 20% affordable housing contribution, that's a way to have a more socially diverse neighbourhood where people from across the income spectrum have access to housing that meets their needs.
Well, that is it's a really complex issue, and your research on this is so respectable. Thank you for taking time out of your day to come into the studio and tell us about that.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation.
That was Dr. Adam Crowe, a Curtin Research Fellow, chatting to us about the hidden costs in Australian housing. It has just gone 9:47 and you're listening to On the Record here on RTRFM.